Dear wonderful listeners, if you're looking to define your brand's core message but aren't sure where to start, that's where Smart Beauty can help. We're offering a 90-minute deep dive into your brand to give you clear action points on your messaging and strategy to help you grow and scale, so that you can get noticed by customers, retailers, and investors, and start to see sales soar. And the cost of this deep dive is redeemable against any larger project you work with us on, so you get all of that insight and value with minimal risk. We're looking for a few new clients who are ready to see amazing results. Just email hello@smartbeautycreative.com to find out more. Hello and welcome to the Smart Beauty Podcast. I'm your host, Viola Levy, beauty journalist and founder of copy-led branding agency, Smart Beauty Creative. We're here to create your brand voice and craft the story behind it. Today, I'm speaking with Mandy Aftel, a pioneering natural perfumer, author and founder of Aftelier Perfumes. For over three decades, Mandy has been crafting exquisite fragrances using only natural materials. Her influential book, Essence and Alchemy, published in 16 languages, became what she calls the gateway drug for people entering perfumery. She's also co-authored books on flavour with Michelin-starred chef Daniel Patterson, bridging scent and taste. Mandy's passion for natural essences extends to her museum, where visitors can explore rare historical artefacts and experience the fascinating world of natural perfumery firsthand. In today's conversation, we'll explore Mandy's fascinating journey from psychotherapist to perfumer, her philosophy of creating beauty through scent, and her unique approach to business that prioritises quality, authenticity, and personal connection over rapid growth. Join us as we delve into the sensory world of natural essences and discover how these ancient materials continue to captivate and connect us to our shared human experience. Hope you enjoy the chat. Mandy, thank you so much for being on the podcast. Really lovely to be speaking with you today. Can you take us back to the beginning, like how your journey with scent began and what drew you to the world of natural perfumery?
So I started with books. I was a psychotherapist for artists and writers, for creative people. I had written three books, and I had decided that I was going to write a novel and make my main character a perfumer. And I really don't have any idea why I thought that. But I liked research. My first book was on a rock and roll star, Brian Jones, who's founded the Rolling Stones. And I like research. I like going around and finding things out. So I started to get old books at book fairs and bookstores. This was kind of before the internet. This was 30 years ago. And I loved what I read. I just thought the world of scent was amazing and interesting. And with a friend, I took a little class on making a solid perfume at an aromatherapy studio nearby. And I loved the materials. And I had a kind of a talent for it from the beginning. And so she said, let's start a perfume line together. I'll do the business. You'll do the creating. And we did. We started a line of perfumes, and it debuted at Neiman Marcus. At Bergdorf Goodman's, and the friendship and the perfume business fell apart very quickly. But by then I was, I'd say, obsessed with what I was doing, and went on, but didn't exactly go on with the business. I felt I couldn't go on with the business. I felt I learned a lot from that and thought I was not a good candidate for business, and wrote a book called Essence and Alchemy. Because by then I had collected all these books and all the stuff I had started back then. And I wanted to write about it. And I did. And that book caught on. It got published in 16 languages all over the world. It was kind of became the gateway drug to most people who get in this field, whether they work with naturals or naturals and synthetics. Mm. And it was the first book that compared the steps and process of alchemy to perfume making. And I got to just put all the things I knew into that particular book. So I had the book, and I thought maybe at that point I would do custom perfume because I didn't like repeating myself. And I thought I wouldn't have to have a business. I just do, onesies of customs. But people asked for things. And so I ended up with one perfume, and then I ended up with two. And by then the internet had come in and I could kind of do it on the internet. And I went on, started teaching people. I had been teaching people. Kind of everything I do now, I sort of went on doing in my, what I thought of as in my small way. I was very interested when I wrote Essence and Alchemy of how people didn't know that perfumes were majorly synthetic or didn't know about ingredients. So I wanted to work with the chef so we could do some things together and educate people about the importance of ingredients. And from there, I wrote, ended up writing two books with Chef Daniel Patterson, who is a 2-star Michelin chef, about flavor. And from there, I got into having essential oils and flavor and working with people that way. And everything kind of came together that way of what I did, but slowly until the stuff I've done for 25 years, I'm still doing.
That's amazing. And how did your kind of career as a writer and a psychotherapist shape the way you approach scent and creativity?
Well, having been a psychotherapist for a long time, you learn a lot about other people's lives, which I loved because I'm very nosy in all ways. And I loved learning about other lives that weren't my own. I find other people incredibly interesting, and I think about how things go a lot. So it sort of set me free of a lot of things. I'm that way by nature. By my own nature, I'm interested in things very deeply, but not that many things. And I'm not one who would follow the herd. I like figuring things out for myself. So watching all those lives, from my perspective, I thought it was a bad idea to do anything that your soul wasn't into. It didn't really resonate for you, or to do things to please others in terms of your choices in life. I don't mean not to please people you love, but I mean to take on face value a life that is not your own and follow that, to find your own way. So when I got into business, and particularly my experience with my first business, Grand Deflorum, which followed more of a real business model, I just thought, I'm not going to do any of that stuff. I'm just not going to do it because it doesn't look good to me. And I'm not interested in being in a lot of doors or being bought out, all of which I've had enormous possibilities for. So I'm by nature, make my own decisions, and all of my experiences there for me fed into following your own star.
Yeah, and what was it about the business journey that just didn't appeal to you? Is it just not where your heart lay, the kind of, you know, the whole thing of building a business and the hustle and the kind of all the different moving parts involved in that? You just wanted to focus on the perfumery and the
the books and stuff. I did build a business. I have an unbelievably successful business. I really do. And it has been successful since day one. So it isn't that it's been unsuccessful. But it's small. I don't want to grow. I make everything myself. So I like the actual craft and process of working. So I want to do everything. So once it gets too big, I'm not interested anymore, which puts me in kind of the catbird seat of turning away many, 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 many things. There's a extremely successful brand there that asked me to make all their perfumes, and I said no. I say no almost all the time. It's very rare I'll say yes, but I am very, very interested in having a business and love having a business. And I love the values of my business. So I like that, but it's not involved in growing in the way that I see most things growing. And I'm always advising my students not to grow that way,
no,
which could be counter to your whole program.
No, that's fair enough. And you know, what was it that you think about when you wrote Essence and Alchemy that really resonated with people that you were saying about perfumery that hadn't been said before?
I don't know. I spoke my heart. I thought what I found in perfume was so unbelievably interesting. and so rich. And I see that in my museum as well. When you start with the essences, they resonate with every culture and every period of time, every kind of person, every sexuality. It's like breathing. So the materials themselves are the gold. And having an art process where you make beauty and you put beauty in the world and you connect to people through having made beauty for them seems to me a wonderful way to live your life. I feel personally that a lot of things about that you're told to do about business don't really work, because I've seen over 30 years so many things come and go.
What things specifically would you say people get told that don't actually work?
Growing, figuring things out in the beginning. I don't think you figure things out in the beginning. I think you put one foot in front of the other and you grow with what you've done. I think the focus on your customer and at both educating and giving them an experience to a customer. I always say anybody can get a customer. It's a repeat customer that makes a business. So we have an unbelievable amount of repeat customers. We even have them in the museum. Over half of our people in the museum that visit us come back. They stand there and they say, I'm going to bring my brother. I'm going to bring my cousin. My mother's coming to town. I got to bring my neighbor. And they do. So I feel like the model, I feel business is a sacred, wonderful activity if you do it in a way that's meaningful. And you certainly, if you do it around scent. So I'm a great believer in it, but not in the large commercial way that often people think is the only way.
Yeah, because it's putting things out into the world and educating people, I guess, and showing them, like, you know, a different way of life or a new experience, or asking them to maybe look at the world in a different way.
Also, I am forever tweaking everything. So nothing I've done do I not take feedback from the world and change. Many things I feel I did wrong, or I always feel I can do it better. So I'm always working on what I'm doing. My class, I have a booklet for my class. We change it every class, because every time I'm in class, I think, oh, I think I could do that better. Or they have a little kit of oils that they buy when they study with me. And every so often I change a couple of them because I think they're not carrying their weight for learning. And I like that process. I find that process growing for me.
So it's kind of an ongoing evolution, as opposed to having a blueprint at the start and then
sticking
to it religiously.
Yes, for me it is.
And you mentioned your museum. Can we talk about, like, because I've still yet to visit, but what does a perfume museum consist of? Like, what was the story behind that?
This is my book. This is my book about it, which I'm so proud of. And it's got pictures. Like, we have a cabinet of curiosities. We have so many things. So when I started out through the books, through getting these old books at either bookshops or book fairs or writing letters, because the internet wasn't up. So you really had a hunt, which I love. I love having hunted for the things in the museum, and I loved hunting for the books. And I felt worried I don't have much hunting left. Not because I'm old, but because I have so much of what I wanted. But when I started out, when I'd get a book, sometimes someone would have a hand-tinted postcard. Or when I went to London, which is my favorite city in the entire world. My most favorite city. I really, really, really love London. And I would go to the antiques fairs. And when I was there, they would have pages and pages from old books. They take the books apart. And I would be looking for an engraving of a musk, or an engraving of a beaver, or engraving of a civet. So I would get these old things. I wasn't as drawn to the finished product, like perfume bottles and labels and things like that. But anything that was used in production, I was interested in. So I would begin to have her old maps about perfume or old catalogs. So I had 50% of what I had in the museum way before we opened. It was all over my house. So I had old books, I had old maps, old engravings. I had a whole collection of 100-year-old essential oils, more than a collection, actually, like 100-year-old sandalwood. I had so many interesting things related to the production of perfume and the making of essences. So when we did the museum and wanted to display that, I had to figure out how to make it an experience, which was really fun. It took me 3 years and counting, because we opened 3 years after I started working on it, but we weren't where we are now. First of all, COVID came in between, but we were always working on how to explain that wondrous world of scent, but also to make it really beautiful. Really beautiful. And I think the most common sentence I said when we were working on it to my husband and my son, because we did it together, was, you know, people go to school for this. We don't know what we're doing. That was huge. That was the thing I said most of the time. And so it's very, very satisfying that to the week, we're only open one day a week. It's a very idiosyncratic place. People say how beautiful it is. And what an unusual experience it is. It's very, very satisfying. And they learn. We have exhibits outdoors. We have all the smelling outdoors. And I have 150, 125 roses in my garden. So, and they're just blooming. So it's like, you know, it's just amazing out there. I mean, it's like roses on steroids, really beautiful. And then people smell, and I have little educational exhibits for them. So I have a breakdown of a perfume of mine, note by note, chord by chord, and then the final perfume. I have an exhibit that's naturals and synthetics of ginger, vanilla, and jasmine, so they can smell them side by side. I have all the animalics. I have real musk, real civet, whatever, they can smell those. And I have taxidermied versions of them indoors. I have a breakdown of rose into its major rosy aroma molecules. And then I have rose absolute that I buy from the grower in Turkey. I have 100-year-old oils and modern oils, five of them next to each other so you can smell them. So people go away with an experience of the materials where they've learned something. And often I just see them find something of themselves.
Yeah.
I now have, which I didn't have when I started because they're so expensive, I have three herbals from the 1600s, which, you know, they only printed them once. So I have the ones from 400 years ago. I have a book of secrets from 1595. And people get a little cotton glove so they can touch everything. They can touch all the old books, and I like them to read a page. And I have just, you know, stuff that I delight in and I want to share with people. And it's very special.
And what are the main things you'd want people to take away having visited? Like, what are the main kind of things that people learn about scent that they didn't know before?
I think the first thing is about being alive to it, how it vivifies your experience. I feel like they just turn on to their sense of smell. And I think that it also becomes alive to them outside of perfume. So perfume is the most commercial and farthest end of smell. But there's lots of smell before that, before you go to a department store and buy a bottle of perfume that you can partake of. That's there for them. So anything about their sense of smell, whether it's from cooking or drinking or mixed drinks. And I have very old books about drinking and flavor from the 1800s that are very focused on scent. I think they leave and they're happy. I mean, I just they really, really look happy. They're happy when they're with us, and they look happy when they leave. We give them four scent strips. They get a little, what we call a little kit with the glove, the little cotton glove, and then a little piece of wool, which is how you can refresh your olfactory palate, and they smell 50 things. And then we have four little scent strips. that we had made for our museum, and they can pick from an organ of 200 materials which ones they want dipped, including ungodly expensive stuff and weird stuff. So if you have a group of say four people, they have 16 strips.
Yeah.
And I see them standing in my driveway, passing the strips back and forth and talking and laughing after they've left about what they picked. Oh, she has butter. I got butter. Oh my God. Or whatever. Cause I have the most amazing natural essences because I sell 100 of them and I've been sourcing for them for 30 years. So the best of the best are there, and it's fun.
And you've championed like natural perfumery before it became a trend. I mean, how would you say scent can differentiate a brand in today's kind of crowded beauty world?
Well, I think the first step is if it really is using naturals. I mean, because there's so much dishonesty in the marketing of perfume, and certainly in the marketing of naturals. So if a brand is really using naturals, which many more are now, or doing mixed media, which I have nothing against. Many of my students are very successful in mixed media and in naturals because they're all over the place with perfume.
By mixed media, you mean that's a blend of naturals and synthetics?
Yeah, that's a term for a blend of naturals. And many people that study with me go on and use both. I think you have to educate the consumer to buy naturals. If you really have naturals, because the consumer expects a perfume to be put on in the morning and last all day. And that will never happen with naturals. So my tagline for my business is, how would you like to buy something that's in a much smaller bottle that doesn't last more than a couple hours and costs a lot more money? Does that sound good to you? Because if it does, my brand could be of interest. So when people call me up and they say, you know, I love Eternity by Calvin Klein, and what do you have? And they do. And I answer the phone because I'm very interested. I always say, oh, don't buy my stuff. You will be so disappointed. Do not buy my stuff. So I spend a lot of time talking people out. I do spend actually a lot of time talking people out of buying my stuff, buying more, all of it. Like, I don't want to see my stuff on eBay. So I'm very careful with people when I'm the person there to not have them buy anything that they may not want. So I don't have any rush to make a sale. I always think you should think about that. Or if someone I see buys a full bottle, I will sometimes call them up and say, I noticed you didn't get samples. You know, like to just start with samples. I can't tell you if I was planning something that would work to get customers, that would be one of the things. People love if you're not desperate for a sale at any cost or at any lie.
Yeah, I'm learning this myself as a business owner that it's definitely about quality over quantity, isn't it? And it can be
if you want. If you love what you do and you want to be in it for the long run, it's the only way to go. It's the only way to go and how you'll grow. People buy something, but they also buy an experience. People want something with their money past an empty promise. They want something. And I feel like it's an honor with a crowded market out there for people to shop with me. I do. And also, I'm unhappy. If someone doesn't like what they got from me, I don't feel good about that. I don't want that experience at all. It doesn't make me feel good. If they're unhappy with anything from me, I want to be an exchange of joy for me and for them. And that's very important. That's more important to me than the sale, way more important.
And I think a lot of brands now are trying to kind of connect with their customers kind of more emotionally through scent. What would be your advice for, say, a sort of a non-fragrance brand, so maybe a skincare brand or something like that, trying to, build a more kind of emotional connection with their customer in that way?
They have to feel it themselves. Whatever reason they started that skincare brand, if that's real and deep for them, nothing Nothing will communicate that more than them communicating it. Nothing should be between them and that customer feeling that, that what they're doing down to the package, down to everything, is important to them, and they've thought that through, and that that customer's happiness is important to them. And that you do one person at a time.
Yeah, for sure. Because it's almost like they're putting themselves in the customer's shoes, and they're having to kind of go through that experience first and then communicate it to their audience.
But most of the time, which I'm never going to do, everyone here and people in my class always say to me, would you please write a business book? But I don't, because my view of business, I think, and I'm very interested in it, is just my own, through my own experience. And I think it's sad that so many people fall into marketing and marketing that's not honest when they have a product that they really believe in. They get swayed by marketing gurus of how they should do their brand. And I feel like it's bad. I see that with people who study. I can see them making that turn. And I think, oh, no.
Yeah, they almost try and work out who their customer is and sort of try and get inside of the mind of their customer rather than just offering something that's authentic.
From the inside.
Yeah.
From your inside out. And also getting too big too fast, getting money in. All those things I don't think lead to anything good.
And obviously, like, storytelling, which is the business that I'm in, is obviously crucial importance to a brand. And I think that, you know, using raw ingredients like you do, there's so much scope for really beautiful sort of storytelling and authenticity. Would you agree with
the materials? All the storytelling is about, there isn't any story that isn't that. The problem is often it's only storytelling. So yeah, everyone, either people who use it or people who don't, tell that story. So that story gets, I think the customer wonders when it says it has Italian bergamot, when it's not Italian and it isn't bergamot, what is in there?
Yeah.
So I feel like storytelling as a more important value than honesty is a problem.
Yeah.
So when you're out there advising those people, it would be the first thing I would tell them.
No, definitely. We're not in the business of spinning yarns.
Also, the customer is much more educated now. 100%. That's a real difference. And I think I've played a role in that with my writing. Yeah. I think the customer knows a lot. I see that in the museum. That's my big petri dish is the museum, because we have, we're only open one day, but we have, say, 50, 60 people every Saturday. And I go talk to every single one of them. And there are absolute, you know, people who, you know, would swing garlic in front of perfume, they hate it, to people who are, you know, have hundreds of bottles, and everybody in between. And I go and talk to them, and they know stuff, and they're curious, and they want to know stuff. They're really, really interested in know things. The customer is a savvy person now. It's really changed. You know, it isn't just an ad in a glossy magazine with a beautiful thing there. People really are down in the weeds in a great way.
Definitely. And there's, when it comes to like our sense of smell, there's just so much to learn, and there's so much wonderful science behind it that often gets overlooked in the kind of glossy mainstream world of perfumery. I mean, in this kind of day and age where people are kind of chasing like novelty or the latest kind of buzzy new ingredient, you know, your focus is on these kind of ancient materials and traditions. I mean, what can modern sort of beauty entrepreneurs learn from that like reverence for history?
Oh, it's so delicious, you know, to use materials that have played such a major role in culture and in who we are, despite all our differences, whatever the rituals were, whatever the complexness of the smell, of its use in food, the fact that you're using these materials that, say, Cleopatra used, or other very famous people throughout history, that they are still around, and that they're still beautiful, and they're still special, is what links us together as people. And I think you feel that when you're in touch with that. And if you have a beautiful version, which takes some doing, but if you have a really beautiful rose absolute, or you have a fantastic vanilla, it's really a running head start in anything you make. Because it's like the difference between a great tomato and a tomato that's kind of, it's all around the ingredients, a lot like food. And so there's just a sense internally to the maker, to the brand owner, that that's what they're working with, that beauty, that care, that craft. And I think that comes across, because no one needs perfume. No one needs it at all. It's not necessary. It's not necessary to kind of like nutrition. People do it because they need it for another reason. And that reason's beauty. And so starting with really beautiful things and making something more beautiful out of beauty is such an amazing thing. And then someone having that experience. And I find with my perfumes, when people get in touch with me or talk to me about them, they have an experience with them. And oftentimes it's the experience I wanted them to have. Yeah. So some of my perfumes are sad, and some of my perfumes are happy, and some of my perfumes are about grief, and some of them are about a certain kind of experience. And sometimes people will get it, like a message in a bottle, and I'll feel very complete and thrilled that that's happened.
And I think that the beauty about perfume is that you, as you know, as yet can't digitize it. So it's that kind of tangible, visceral, immediate experience that I think sets it apart. I mean, do you think consumers are craving that more and more these days when they're kind of...
Oh, I think there's no question. And I think it changes your mood. It's animal. It takes place on the skin. It's got that animal quality. Oftentimes it's different on different people. It's personal. It's ritualistic. It's for you. I think it's first for you. It reflects your mood, where you are. There's not enough good things to say about the experience of finding perfume or perfumes that speak to you. Like I do custom perfume. I did it from the beginning. I do it still. And I've done them for the same person more than once. And I find when they come back for a custom perfume, I look at what they've chosen, because it goes from ingredient. They smell essences. That's how I do it. Even though I'm a psychologist, I don't do it by questionnaire at all. They pick different things because it's like a snapshot of where they are now. So perfume is a bit like that. And then in more years and more things happen, you're attracted to other things, which is how you identify yourself in space and time and sensually as you go on. And also some people respond to perfume where in the beginning, maybe something that's more easy to like would be a preference. And then as people know more, they get more curious. And they get more curious for odder ones. So like if I'm on the phone and I'm recommending stuff of my line, I usually pick with my try. I usually start with my sort of right down the middle, tried and true. Most people like this, you know, unless I get a sense they've got a little bit of something else going on. And then I pick more some of my weirder ones. And it's they are, to me, they're little personalities, those perfumes.
No,
and then they hook up with your personality.
And I think everyone, you know, smells differently, don't they? So it's incredibly subjective.
Yes.
And there's a lot of, you know, brands that are now kind of trying to move over into the holistic wellness sphere. And I think scent plays a huge part in that. I mean, do you think the conversation about sort of perfume kind of being the new aromatherapy and the way that it affects people's, it can help with people's mental health and help sort of with things
yes.
like being
yes.
mindfulness?
Yes. Yes. So first of all, perfume, particularly if you work with naturals, uses similar materials, but to a certain extent, with more artistry and with a larger palette. But it's still those experiences. And I myself, I'm not an aromatherapist, but I always thought that if it changes your mood or makes you feel good, that's aromatherapy. You know, that is what it does. So I am in complete agreement with that. Anything that brings you that kind of pleasure is a kind of healthy, positive experience for you.
And that's where the alchemy lies, I guess.
Yes, yes, yes.
I guess, do you think that's sort of a big advantage that natural materials have over their synthetic counterparts? I mean, you know, some you get some synthetic scents that are beautiful, but do you think that they can affect our mood and our sort of emotional states in the same way as naturals?
I don't, because of that deep, unconscious human resonance with scented material. There is no culture in the world ever that didn't take pleasure in rubbing scented material from nature on themselves. So whether you know it in this life or don't, your kind of memory, your kind of collective memory, knows about this, experiences this from reading fiction, from seeing movies, from knowing history. There's just something about materials that last as an object of beauty, that if we adorn ourselves with them, we partake of that. And I think we do know that. We just do.
And what, over the course of your journey with perfume, has been the most kind of surprising thing that you've learned along the way about scent or about fragrance in general?
The depth of all you can learn, how long it's gone on. I've been in it for a long time now, 30 years. I'm still learning. I'm still discovering. I'm still turned on. I'm still excited by it. It's very thrilling to me. And the byways that it goes into, you know, the history, the anthropology, food, medicine, death rituals, you name it. It goes into these other alchemy, other areas, full on. It's kind of got its wings. It flies in so many directions that are rich and deep about human life in a timeless way, in a way that's not just now, but has been proven forever. So I find that very reassuring. And as I learn, you know, as I, through reading and through teaching and through experimenting and making things, I find this aliveness factor where it's not ho-hum. Oh, I know that. It's just even still learning how to make perfumes better, how to listen to the materials, which is really what's most important to me. And I have my own way of working, which I teach, which is called the slow scent method. And also finding out more about the materials, or just when you put two essences together, they change each other. And then when you add a third, that one changes. So it's like cooking, but very, very interesting to see what happens at this titration and that titration and what comes out and what you make. I still find that process incredibly interesting to make for myself and also to figure out to teach. So I like all that.
And you mentioned cooking. I mean, there's a lot of kind of food inspired like scents and beauty brands emerging at the moment. Do you see that kind of trend continuing? Because there is a huge crossover, isn't there, with
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, their scent and flavor are allied. I have a line of flavor drops. I've had that since I did my first cookbook with Chef Daniel Patterson. And so a lot of small brands, everything small with me, small ice cream brands and sommeliers and restaurants and vintners and candy makers and buy my flavor drops to use in food. And when you put them together, it's a lot like making a perfume. We did a book like that called Art of Flavor, and which is
I have, by the way.
And all of the making a flavor was based on how I make perfume, because we both work the exact same way, him making flavor and me making perfume. So I think it's a very rich vein, very, very rich and exciting vein. And as you know, basil that's like Thai basil is very spicy, but basil that's sort of sweet basil is slightly floral. So here you've got basil, but the facets, the flavor or the scent facets, take it off in other directions. So it's a lot like making perfumes, making a flavor. I think it's very exciting.
Do you like that kind of, that current sort of veering towards very sort of kind of sweet confectionery, like nostalgic almost scents that remind people of like a happier time or a safer time when they were small and, I don't know, baking with their grandma or something like that?
I have a perfume like that called Bohème Confection that's got some very rich florals, like in the middle, it's got pink lotus, but all around it, I have put such foodie stuff. It's very foodie. It's got chocolate and patchouli, but then it's got sarsaparilla and it has maltol. It's wrapped in this sugary, sweet thing with the substantive floral stuff, the heavier stuff right in the middle. And I worked on it for a long time, and it's very foodie until you get all the way down into it.
Oh, wonderful. I'd love to try that someday. It can be very lonely as an independent business owner, as you know. I mean, what sustains you like creatively and emotionally during those times when it, especially imagine during the pandemic as well, when everyone was sort of very isolated?
We closed the museum for a year and a half during the pandemic. And I can't tell you how much I missed it. I really, really missed it. Because we're only open one day, it's like intense socializing for one day and with strangers about something I love. So I loved that experience. I'm very shy, but I talk to people one-on-one and I love that. So I really, really miss that. And I just makes me think talking to people like that. I had loved that. Before the pandemic, I used to teach my class in my studio live. And during the pandemic, I moved it to Zoom because I didn't want to give up my teaching. And I was very anxious about moving it. People loved my class. I taught it a few times a year. People traveled literally from all over the world. It's a little tiny class. It was 10 people. And when I moved my class to Zoom, there were some things that no one ever criticized about my class, but I always thought were terrible. Well, I thought stuff was wrong with Essence and Alchemy too. So I revised it 2 years ago. Nobody had complained about any of these things, but I'm very critical and go on to improve myself. So with Essence and Alchemy, which I revised 2 years ago, I'm very proud of it now. The teaching was so old. It was like when I began, and I knew so much more. I looked at the teaching chapter, I was horrified. I felt like, oh my God, you know, this is terrible. So I revised lots of little things, but I revised a lot about how to learn to make perfume because I didn't feel that way anymore. And in my teaching, when I began to teach on Zoom, which a lot of my students had come before, people come back, I could tell they really thought, ooh, you know, this is going to be a poor imitation of coming to her studio, or when will you teach live again? I'm going to wait. And I'm there for every session. It takes place over a month. It was such an improvement on the class. I got to fix everything that didn't work. Two examples of that. One was in my studio class, I just have my own perfume organ. So if people are making things, they have to share all the bottles. And in my Zoom class, I curated a perfume organ that they had to buy. So if I said, let's smell the oak moss with the rose, everybody just picks theirs up and smells. They don't have to wait for it to be passed around. If I say, do you smell how those facets lock? See, now do it with jasmine. Let's see, whatever it was, I could do it immediately, which I loved. And the other thing, which is how I teach, and I also love, I have people make two perfumes in a month and remake it. Then they send me the formulas, and then I make everybody's perfumes. So I make two versions of 10 students' perfumes. That's 20 perfumes. Then I make 200 samples, and then I mail all those samples to the people in the class. Then we analyze the dynamics of what's going, which I find completely fascinating. And then they have those perfumes to revise and work on of each other's, because they all have the same materials. So I found with the isolation of the pandemic, certain other things came forward that I liked even better. And that was a good thing for me. So I don't feel isolated at all. One, because I have my class on Zoom and I have my visitors. But two, I'm so in my head. I'm working on a new book, and I have a book coming out in September. I like the time to think and read and research, which I always have. So I need downtime to refuel, because I'm not an extrovert. So yeah. I'm good with it all.
No, I can completely relate. And what are the, you know, what really pivotal moments have ended up kind of really shaping your journey, like looking back on your career, because you've done so much. I mean, what are the kind of main things that stand out to you as sort of particularly kind of pivotal?
It's a good, really, I have to say, your questions are terrific.
Oh, thank
they're
you.
Really, they're really, really thoughtful, and they're really to the point. And they're things that have made me think about my life. And I've really enjoyed that. So thank you very much.
Pleasure.
I think the first was with my first perfume brand, watching it fall apart, but watching that model of getting investors and money and being in a lot of doors, I was repulsed by it all. And I didn't like it, and I didn't want it. So I think I learned on that. I didn't want to be big. I didn't want to follow. I didn't know what I wanted to follow, but I didn't want to do that. That was important to me to figure that out. I was approached by Henry Bendel's. I mean, it with my own line later, Aftelier Perfumes. And they made me an offer I couldn't refuse. And I went there and I hated it. So I learned then I didn't want to be in stores at all. I was in a small amount of stores. I was in that store. I had an unbelievable deal, but I didn't like it. I remember I went there. I have solid perfumes in sterling silver cases, and they had put a price tag on the bag, and the bag looked terrible. I'm very fussy. Yeah. It's come as not a shock. I'm very fussy about everything. And so it looked bad. It had gum on the bag. So I took all the bags home and replaced it. Then some of them had been left open. They dried out. I just thought, like, I can't have my goods. Like, I have to, you know, really control what a person gets, because it matters to me. So I decided I couldn't be in a store. That was important to me. That was pivotal to me. Opening the museum was huge. And working on it all that time and not knowing what I was doing. And it turned out so great. And I thought when I was doing it, I got very clear that even if no one ever came, which was pretty much what I thought, and in the beginning we were all staring at each other in there at different hours, my husband, my son, and I thought, this is still worth it. If we reach two people and they learn how great this world is, that they would never come in contact with this stuff, if we could share this amazingly beautiful, interesting stuff with a few people, I would be happy. And for me, the museum was like all the disparate, strange things I found and put together in Essence and Alchemy coming to life. I felt like I'd made that book come to life, because the world I've made in Essence and Alchemy didn't really exist. It just existed in my imagination from all the things I found, and I pieced all that together. So that was amazing. And I'd say a turning point was quite recently and quite thrilling. The very famous perfumer Jean-Claude Elena the perfumer for Hermes came to my museum
Oh,
and
wow.
visited. And my book, my museum book, had just come out in Italian and in French. And it was beyond getting him a book because they would literally come out that week. We bought one on Amazon and had it air expressed from French Amazon because we couldn't even get a copy from the publisher. And I really, really wanted to give him a book. First, I'm very proud of the book, but I wanted to have him have it. Such a major figure. And we had such a good time. And he was so admiring of it. That was very pivotal. And I'd say another very pivotal experience for me, which is along the same lines, was when the magazine Nez published my book in French,
oh, wow.
which is the beginning of my career. I mean, I can't even begin to tell you of the incredibly famous perfumer, who, which I'm not going to say who he's very well known and very esteemed, just and another perfumer. Oh, Mandy, are you still working with naturals? Aren't you bored? Or you can't make a good perfume with naturals. Or, you know, this isn't going to work what you're doing. To see it being embraced where people had never really paid attention to it before, it was very satisfying to my heart because it was hurtful and in the beginning. And so I just felt... it was like a balm. It was very soothing to have those experiences later. Special.
Definitely. Because there is quite a lot of gatekeeping, I feel like, in the world of fragrance. And there is kind of a Swiss-French kind of cultural dominance in that sense. So I think it's great that there are people like yourself that are doing something different and flying the flag for perfume, you know, sort of perfume scenes in the US and elsewhere.
Which I feel is... moribund. You know, there are cultures all over the world and people all over the world that just take such a pleasure in this. And I feel like there are great numbers of them now, of people who are self-taught or people who just love the stuff or want to buy it or learn. I mean, that's just old hat now. And because of people like you educating people, and it's just exciting. It's a part in a world that is so hard and so ugly at times for people to have access to beauty and care of themselves and of others. It just seems a crime for people to not be able to have that. So it's great that that's all happened.
And what would be, we're nearly at the end of our time, but what would be the future of the fragrance world that you'd like to see?
More honesty, more people being more honest about what they're doing, and people doing things for a reason that they feel is deep for them, and not being dissuaded by marketing or things that they hear. And I don't mean your marketing, I mean the marketing in the larger world, to really build something of quality step by step. And not get ahead of where they are, to take what they've learned from this step and not over leverage themselves, maybe start very small and keep growing and keep learning in a way that brings them joy and brings joy to other people. That, I think, makes a better world.
Beautifully put. Well, Mandy, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. It was so lovely chatting with you. And yeah, really can't wait to sort of hear what you get up to next, and would love to visit your museum once I make it to the West Coast. I'm definitely coming to visit.
Thank you. I would love that. And thank you for a lovely time. Bye-bye.
I hope you enjoyed that episode. All links will be in the show notes, and feel free to visit smartbeautycreative.com or visit us over on Instagram to find out more about what we do. And if you enjoyed listening, please don't forget to rate and review Smart Beauty on iTunes, as it helps people find us. See you next time.